Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuacis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation. Well, hello everybody, this is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from Booger County in Mid-America and the mysterious Ozarks, and this is Prophecy Keepers Radio. And our guest this week, and this will be the guest beginning Saturday, the 3rd of July, is Eduardo Holman. And we're going to be talking about curanderismo. I guess that's the belief in, well, the way I understand, I really don't know a whole lot about the subject, but I understand that curanderos deal with herbs and potions and things like that. So before I show too much of my ignorance, Eduardo, why don't you go ahead and fill the folks in. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Blue Otter. Yeah, my people down here call me Eduardo. I've always gone by my middle name, Bryant, all my life, and I'm known as Bryant Holman to a lot of people, and but my first name is Edward, and when I first moved to Mexico, people couldn't pronounce Bryant, so I just started telling them my name was Eduardo, and that's what everybody calls me now. But I have studied the subject of curanderismo, which is to say it's the belief or faith system or healing system of these people who are known as curanderos, if they're men, and then the women are called curanderas, and that's, they have, you know, they have different endings of a lot of words based on if they're male or female. So curanderismo is the name of the practice of these people who are known as either curanderos or curanderos.
Oh, so it's like in Latin, Latin is the ism, is the, you know, colonialism would be the belief in a colonial, you know, so curanderismo is the belief in curanderos or curanderas, or their practice.
Yeah, that's sort of what kind of what it amounts to. Yeah, that's what it is. And it can be confused with another related subject, which is called brujería, and that literally means witchcraft. And a lot of people kind of confuse the two terms, and it's easy to confuse them because there are people who sort of practice both, or it's not really clear what they do, and so a lot of people use the term brujitas or brujitos, which is the diminutive term, and that's as if to say the dear little witches, actually, if you were to translate it correctly. And that's to imply, like, they may be harmful, and they may be people who do harm, and they may not be people to do harm.
It's kind of like in English, it's calling somebody a white witch.
Yeah, that's essentially it, because they do divide the practices that they know as witchcraft or that they know as brujería into white magic and black magic, and then they have these other sort of variations that are called red magic and green magic. But the basic things that people are concerned with are the white magic and the black magic.
Hmm, interesting. I didn't know that.
So I've got to say that there are people who believe that most of this is based in indigenous culture, and that's sort of what people want to believe, or that's the popular belief, and it's given more emphasis. But generally, when it comes to Mexican history and Mexican culture, people kind of generally tend to do that anyway. They tend to look for the the indigenous roots in just about everything, and kind of discount the Hispanic roots, and to see it all in a pretty two-dimensional way, and especially see the Spanish in a real two-dimensional sort of way, you know, as if they were this monolith that all of them thought the same thing, and they were all involved in the same practices and all that sort of thing. And that's really not true, because Spain was a very dynamic society, and when the Spanish came over to the New World, you know, at the time of the conquest, they had just barely consolidated the power of the Catholics over the Iberian Peninsula. Before then, there were pretty large territories that were still in control of the Moors, you know, so their culture was integrated into Hispanic culture, and then a lot of those people were later on expelled because, especially the Muslims and the Jews, because they had been forcibly converted to Catholicism, and the Inquisition felt like they were secretly practicing their old beliefs and their old rituals and all that sort of thing. And so in order to keep from leaving the Spanish world, as it were, you know, they were given the option to come over to the New World. So really a lot of the original Spanish settlers, not necessarily the conquistadors or the elites that ruled everything, but just the sort of foot soldiers and the colonists who came over here were people that had been expelled or exiled or were given the choice of coming over here rather than going to North Africa or to Turkey or someplace like that.
I guess 1492, that was the year not only Columbus's so-called discovery of the Americas, but that was the year that they kicked the Jews out of Spain also, wasn't it?
I'm not sure if that's the date that they kicked the Jews out, but that might be true, yeah. But they that's when they told them that they had to either convert to Catholicism or leave. And actually, most of them did convert to Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them, there had been a big discussion going on for a long time as more and more territory was taken over by the Catholics, was taken from the Moors. In the Jewish community, they had the discussion about what they called Jewish martyrdom, which is to say, would they die rather than convert? Hmm. And the Spanish actually didn't tell them they had to die or convert. They told them they had to convert or leave. And consequently, most of them actually did convert. But later on, these people were accused of what they called Judaizing, which is to say that they were accused of secretly practicing Jewish rituals. And in fact, a lot of them were, because most of the people from Spain who settled in New Mexico, for instance, were this group that are sometimes known as the Crypto Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these families actually have these traditions, but a lot of the family members don't even know that these are family traditions, because only the women in the family pass this information on to their daughters, and a lot of times the men do not know that they come from crypto-Jewish families. But one giveaway...
I guess the Sephardic... I've got a friend, Donald Panther Yates. He's a professor at Georgia Southern. He's done quite a bit of research into this, and he was able to find out... that the key families in the Southeast that brokered the treaties and were also, you know, Indian agents and traders and helped the families that helped the Indians the most, at least in the Southeast, of course they were traders and merchants also, were crypto-Jewish families.
Yeah, I don't doubt that.
Like the Perrymans. The Perrymans and actually the... one Chickamauga Cherokee chief, the Bowles, he was a descendant of, Chief Perryman's, it was the Perrymans that married into the Creek chiefs, and William Augustus Bowles, who was also Chief Bowles' father, had two wives, a Cherokee wife and a Creek wife, and... So that Perryman line was crypto-Jews. Anyway, Donald Panther Yates has done a lot of interesting work on the subject. And I follow it because, you know, there's a lot of people that talk about Cherokees and other people being... Well, there have been voluminous books written about it, like in the 1700s. But really, I think what it is the similarities between Lost Israel and, like, Cherokees... Probably is because we both originate from the same source, which is like Samaria. You know, the Egyptians, the Hittites, the Phoenicians, a lot of different people have a similar culture, and there were a lot. There were 11 other tribes other than the Judah in Israel. You know, the House of Israel was 12 tribes, not just one. And after the Israel split into two kingdoms, north and south, and the ones that were faithful to the one God lived in south around Jerusalem, and Ephraim and most of the tribes were in, north, and they became paganized. They were carried captive away and eventually dispersed all throughout the north countries. But what constitutes the Jews of today? Jews today are actually not strictly Judah, but they are people that are descendants of all the tribes of Israel that were faithful, and they fall under the label Jews today. But they actually could be of Dan or the House of Joseph or Asher or Gad or Reuben or any of them.
Well, the Ashkenazi Jews, which are the ones in Europe, most of them are actually descendants of a tribe called the Khazars.
That's right. Yeah, they're about.
They all converted to Judaism because their king, you know, asked for missionaries to come from these different religions, and they were convinced that they wanted to become Jews rather than Catholics, Orthodox Eastern Orthodox Christians,
but the
Muslims, and that's what they did.
Right.
But the Sephardic mm-hmm. Jews are well, nominally they're the people that that lived in Palestine, you know, during the mm-hmm. during the time that the Jews were there, which were historically relatively short periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they, you know, they were conquered by David, and then for the next several generations or whatever, they actually controlled a reasonable amount of territory, and then they were expelled, and their power was broken.
Oh, 70
and
years.
And then it was a rather long time before they came back and had a modicum of power. But even
yeah.
then, the party that's generally known as the Maccabees, I mean, they came to power as these rebels because the
mm-hmm.
the Seleucids were off fighting a war over on their eastern end of their empire over in Afghanistan, and they thought they were going to lose, and when they won, they were going to come back and they were going to slaughter them.
Well,
and they immediately sought help from the Romans, and they became a Roman protectorate.
Mm-hmm.
So they were never even an independent state. And then also, it's been shown that the House of Israel at the time of David and Solomon and all of those people, they were actually suzerains of the Babylonians,
mm-hmm.
where they were collecting taxes for them and
yeah.
what have you. But they were
suzerains, a subordinate king, for those who don't understand that term.
Right, and they were, but they were latecomers on the scene, and really the oldest culture that had any influence in that area. Far and away, you know, were the Egyptians, and of course
oh, yeah.
they had several different races and ruling families
mm-hmm.
and cliques and tribes that were centered in different cities that had their moment in the sun and ruled everybody else.
And then in the west, then the Mauritanians, which was a triracial society,
right?
And, you know, I guess about seven, a little bit of history here, folks. So about 70 years after the time of Jesus, Jerusalem was destroyed. You know, there literally wasn't a stone left standing on each other. They think they know where the Temple Mount is because of the Western Wall. And so there was a remnant of Jews that went through the Mediterranean and ended up in the area of Spain. They're called the Sephardic Jews. Then Masada, I don't know what the year of Masada was, but At the time of Jesus, the people that were in control in Jerusalem were the Pharisees, and Pharez was one line. There were twins that were born to Judah, the Pharez line and the Zerah line, and I believe Zerah's hand was born first, and they tied a scarlet thread around it, but then it was pulled back in, and then the other child was born first. And Britain claims to be descendants of the House of Israel through Zerah. That's the reason why they tie all their documents in scarlet. It's the reason why you have the Lion of Judah and the, which is a symbol of the Lion of Judah, and the heavily chained unicorn. Unicorn's a symbol of the priesthood. So,
well,
let me
try to focus all of this back on Mexico.
Yeah, we're getting too far afield.
Because that's where I'm going to. Of course, what I was saying was that Spain was a very complex society, and that nominally there were three groups there. There were the Christians, who were known as the Mozarabs, because they which was like a put down sort of term. It meant Arab wannabes. And they were like the bottom rung of the society, but in Muslim Spain they composed probably up to 90% of the population. And then the other part of the population were known as the Moors, and a lot of people mistakenly think that they were Arabs, but actually they weren't. They were Berbers mostly from the Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some Arab blood. I mean, their very top leadership was Arab, but then these Arab families married into these Moorish families, and they're, you know, after a few centuries, there were no pure Arab blood people there. But the other group were the Jews, because they were there because they were tolerated more so than they were any place else. And there's a really wonderful book about society in Spain in that period that I really recommend. It's called the Ornament of the World. And it tells the story of the history of Spain during the Muslim period. But what I'm concerned with is actually are the Jews, but not because so much of their history as far as their being Jewish, but because their society was also very complex in Palestine, because there were people who had integrated into Jewish culture but who were not Jews, and their existence was very similar to that of the crypto Jews. There was this one tribe who were actually from Egypt, and according to their living traditions, they were the people who ruled Egypt before the people that we know as the ancient Egyptians mm-hmm. arrived there. And a lot of these people, they became crypto-Jews, but sort of within that culture, they were something else. They were these crypto-Egyptians at the time that they were during their sojourn in Palestine, when they were pretending to be Jews. And these are the people who actually brought the magical traditions over to Mexico that form a large part of the culture that makes up what we think of as Mexican witchcraft today. Hmm. Now, this is something that I discovered on my own. That took me a lot of studying and a lot of investigating, and mostly just a lot of luck, because I just happened to read the right things that gave me some background on that, so that when I actually met one of these people and he began explaining who he was and who his family was, I knew exactly what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. And since then, the amazing thing is that I began reading these books that are sort of a dubious origin, you know, that are called the Grimorios, and these are books that were around in these Moorish libraries in Spain for a long time, and nobody in Europe even knew they existed. And then later on, people started translating books in general. First, what they were going after were the works of the Greek philosophers, you know, like Plato, for instance, and Aristotle were the more popular ones. But after a couple of centuries, they started people beginning translating other things that were sort of special interest books, and that's when they started translating these into other languages, principally into French. And so the term grimorio was sort of Frenchified, and it became the term grimoire. Mm-hmm. Which is a word that's very popular among people that mm-hmm. are into this sort of modern neo-pagan witchcraft society that's around today, you know. And a lot of these people will say, well, that they, if you tell them, you know, that these books came from Spain and that they really do go back to the time of Solomon, for instance, you know, they're going to be incredulous about that, because sort of Eurocentric archaeology and anthropology, you know, doesn't lend any credibility to that. But I feel like their problem is that they have not investigated it properly. So besides having read what's in some of these books, I've also had this person that I was sort of alluding to, who's a member of one of these families, has sort of agreed to make me sort of like his apprentice. You know, he's been talking me into learning how to become a brujito, let's say, for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I finally agreed to sort of study under him. And so he has me writing down all of these spells, you know, and he expects that I'm going to, like, practice them, but I'm not, you know. But I'm just trying to find out more about this. So I started collecting a lot of that, and then I met this guy who is a professor at this university in Kansas. I can't remember which one it is, but his specialty is the magical texts of the Egyptians of the first century AD who used the Coptic language, which was only recently deciphered. You know, people mm-hmm. have these texts around in these museums all around the world, and they're in these Coptic churches in Egypt, and the owners of them had no idea what what they contained, because they couldn't read the language, or they couldn't read the alphabet. And it turns out that they're spells, and they were written by these monks that were in these monasteries out, and these hermits out in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula, and their clients would come to them and, you know, request them to do this work for them, and that's what they did. And I'm reading them, and they're almost identical to the things that are in these grimorios, and into the things that this person is teaching me, that I've been writing down in this notebook. And it's, when I was telling this professor about it, you know, he got really wide-eyed. I mean, he was like amazed at what I was telling him about and my theories about it, you know. And he was telling me, you know, that I was going to be amazed to find out how right I was when I found out that, you know, all these things that I was theorizing about turned out to be true. So, you know, the gist of what I'm sort of saying, or what I'm learning, is that there's no question that what is practiced in Mexico today has two sets of roots. That these roots definitely, you know, go back to the practices of the Indians that were here before the Spanish got here. But at the same time, what's being practiced far and wide all over Mexico also has roots that go back to Spain, that they're ostensibly couched in the doctrines and the theology of the Catholic Church. But behind that, there's a much older culture that sort of brought itself under the aegis of the Catholic Church in order to kind of keep them out of trouble from the Inquisition. But that goes back to a time when these people were doing that in Egypt. And in the meantime, they had integrated themselves into Jewish culture, and then later on into the early Christian culture.
Fascinating.
So, go ahead.
I said, that's fascinating.
So, yeah. So what I've tried to do is I have an easy time making friends with these Mexican Indians. We have a lot of them where I'm at. I live on the border. My home is in a place called Presidio, Texas, which is just this little hole in the wall out in the middle of the desert near Big Bend National Park. And across on the other side of the river is the city of Ojinaga, Chihuahua, which is about a town of about 30,000 people. And there are a lot of Indians there, and most of them are Tarahumara Indians who come from what we call the Copper Canyon region, which is down in the southwest part of the state. It's this huge canyon system that they say you can drop the Grand Canyon into it like about 10 times over.
Jeez.
It's huge. And there lives the largest and most primitive tribe in North America, the Tarahumara Indians. And their culture is pretty much untouched by time, but it is modified somewhat, however, because there was a point in their history where they kind of abandoned some of their former practices, and we really don't know what they are. I mean, what they did abandon, but at the same time, when a lot of them thought that they had converted to Catholicism, they really hadn't, because they really didn't understand the doctrine very well at all, and the missionaries that were there with them weren't there very long, until they were actually expelled from the empire because of some kind of problem that they had between the Jesuits and the Emperor of Spain at the time. So they went about 300 years wherein they didn't have any missionaries there, but where they had at least some of them who thought of themselves as being Catholics, but who had really never abandoned their original belief system. So I have read a few anthropology books on that, but also I know a lot of these people. I mean, they're personal friends of mine, and some of them spend most of their time in Ojinaga. Part of the reason is that a lot of them are like exiles. I mean, they can't go back to their tribal homelands, because they've been run off by people who are, well, they're burning down the forest so that they can plant marijuana and poppy plantations is what it probably comes down to. It's pretty sad, but, you know, I try to do what I can to help them and to make their case known to the world, but they're pretty much unprotected, you know, nobody's really doing a lot for them, so a lot of them are just living on the streets all around the state and begging, you know, it's pretty sad. But I've known several who have told me, you know, about the practices of their curanderos, and I've known some whose relatives were curanderos, and I even know one pretty well, I've known him for a long time, who calls himself a curandero's helper, and what he's saying is that his some of his relatives are curanderos, and he helps them do what they do, but he can't do that himself because according to their culture, you're supposed to be born with the ability to do that, and that's something that's common in curanderismo, whether it's indigenous or non-indigenous, is that you're supposed to have an element which they call a don, which literally means a gift, and that means normally something that you were born with, which gives you the ability to heal and to do a lot of other things. But some people can acquire a don by other methods. They can, for instance, if they have a parent or a grandparent who dies, they can that person can give the don to a child. And they also have situations...
Just like a mantle.
Yeah, and they also have situations wherein people can steal other people's don. And that's something that's a little more complicated. And they also have ones where they can take someone's don away and discard it. But these are kind of complex issues, but they're not terribly common, you know, among Tarahumaras they are, but among among anybody else, I don't think that they're all that common. The Tarahumaras, for instance, a lot of their tribal laws have to do with situations involving witchcraft, because it's proscribed. And so there are people, if they're accused of witchcraft and they feel that they can prove it before a person who's has the function of being a tribal judge, then one of the first things that the judge will do is he'll call for a curandero who has the power to take the don away from the other guy. Another thing is that at least in some areas, they make a point of distinguishing between people who do black magic that's based on Indian culture as opposed to those who do black magic that is based on European culture. And the ones that do it that's based on European culture are known as brujos, which means witches, whereas the ones who do this sort of thing that's based entirely in indigenous culture are called hechiceros, and the word means sorcerers. But that's not a universal practice, but it's just something that's common. So, for instance, Tarahumaras refer to all of their brujos as hechiceros, and they say, you know, that brujo is not the correct term, that hechicero is, but of course, Spanish is their second language, you know, they have other terms that they use in their own native language.
Well, that's fascinating. Yeah, I know there's a lot of cultures running around in Mexico. It's a very mysterious place, a very very strange country. Very strange country indeed. And I remember that Don Jaime Perez was talking a little bit about, you know, what goes on down there, and I really enjoyed the interview with him, and he was excited to hear that you were going to come on this show today.
I listened to his interview. In fact, I mean, I downloaded it, and I listened to it twice because I wanted to be real clear about what he was saying, and it's fascinating, you know. But I got to say that he's definitely looking at this from a totally different angle than I am, because he has managed to find cases of well, he was talking about, for instance, that you can go to places and they still have their statues or other representations of their Indian gods, and mm-hmm. they hide behind the altars and that sort of thing. And I don't doubt that that takes place in a lot of places, but I think that it's not really all that common, because that's something that I have looked for myself, to see how much evidence there is of that, and I haven't really found any, you know. And I've been studying this for, I'm going to say, like 13 years.
Yeah, it might just be what he was talking about, his state.
I think it's a local thing. I mean, I think it's a regional thing. There are a lot of regional practices mm-hmm. that... And I think it's also possible for, if you were to, like, convoke a group of, like, tribal elders, and they were all from cultures that they were doing that sort of thing, you know, it would give you the overall impression that it was more common than it really is.
Mm-hmm.
But I belong to this email group that's about the Virgin of Guadalupe. That's the subject. And there's a lot of polemics going on about that, because there's no question but that the shrine of the Virgin of Guadalupe was built on a location where there had formerly been this Indian goddess, who was a goddess of the Mexica tribe, who, you know, we know as the Aztecs.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater. Would you think twice about defending yourself or a loved one from an intruder? In this day and age, would you dream of leaving your doors unlocked at night for fear of being burglarized or even attacked or worse? Would you? But when it comes to our own bodies, the doors to our houses are wide open all the time. The very air we breathe and the food we eat, especially here in the United States, creates free radicals that cause us to age and in some cases cause illness, some of which are deadly. Now, for the first time in history, there's a supplement called Protandim that is listed on the U.S. government's PubMed.gov website, with many peer-reviewed studies all showing that Protandim is a proven killer of the free radicals that are aging and in some cases even killing us. Now, I'm not talking about killing one molecule of free radical per one molecule of antioxidants like the stuff we've been taking. I'm talking about killing 1 million free radicals per second, per molecule, and this is the very same antioxidant your own body produces. Protandim superchargers your body to create much more than it does without Protandim. There's an old saying that we are warned about in the scriptures. That's the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So let me ask you, how much money do you spend on food a day? If you're out shopping or at the beach, would you think anything of spending a buck or even more on a can of soda? If there was a vending machine that sold something that killed what was aging you or even killing you, would you even hesitate to spend a buck and a half a day? Well, now there is such a vending machine, and it's sitting right in front of you. It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
But, of course, the Mexica had only been in the Valley of Mexico for less than 200 years when they were conquered by the Spanish. And then of that period of time, their first 40 years, they were just sort of vassals of their neighbors, you know. And after that, they kind of lucked out and became part of an alliance with some more powerful states who were willing to include them just so that they could have, you know, more soldiers to field against their enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And then after several decades, I suppose, they finally got the upper hand over those guys, and they sort of started calling the shots.
Kind of like Rome.
Yeah, they had what they called the Triple Alliance, and they started calling the shots. But they still, their power would not have stood if their alliance had fell apart. You know, it was dependent on two other cities. One of them was Texcoco, and I can't remember what the other one was. But the person who was probably the most influential in their in the history of the whole group there was this guy who was the king of Texcoco. He was not actually Mexica as such. I mean, they had a similar language. They were all Nahual speakers, which is a dialect of the Uto-Aztecan tongue, which is one of the dominant racial linguistic groups that includes most of the, well, probably half of the Pueblo Indians in New Mexico, and includes the Tarahumaras, and of course it includes the Ute Indians, and it includes the Aztecs. So within that group, the Triple Alliance, like I say, the Mexica eventually wound up on top, but the person who was sort of there at the cultural zenith, or who sort of represents the cultural zenith, was this guy who was the king of Texcoco, and his name was Netzahualcoyotl. Kind of a hard to pronounce name, but he was a historian, you know, and he was a poet, and he was one of those guys that come along occasionally and ban human sacrifice, you know, as long as they're around, you know, and then when he was gone, they went back to doing it again, but he's the person that because of him we know what we know about the Toltecs, because he actually wrote this book, and even though the Spanish managed to burn all these books, you know, one book that did survive that was actually written by him is called The History of the Lords of the Toltecs. And almost everything we know about the Toltecs, about their history, comes from that book, because the Toltecs had disappeared as a viable group probably at least a couple of hundred years before the wave of migrations came into the Valley of Mexico that included such people as the Texcoco group and the Mexica and those people. I was talking about the Toltecs, and what we know about the Toltecs comes from a book that was written by this Aztec king whose name was Netzahualcoyotl. And he was not really the king of Tenochtitlan, which was the capital of the Mexica, but of one of the neighboring cities, which was Texcoco. And we would not know anything really about the Toltecs to speak of, except for archaeological finds, if it had not have been for his book, which was entitled The History of the Lords of the Tolteca. Now, one interesting thing about this man whose name was Netzahualcoyotl is something that's just now been discovered. You know, recently they canonized Juan Diego. You know who Juan Diego is, right? Well,
he was the one that discovered
the Virgin of Guadalupe,
right? And tell the folks a little bit about, you know, about what her cloak and so forth. So what he saw.
Okay, well, the story of the Virgin of Guadalupe goes like this. Supposedly there was this Aztec Indian peasant whose name was Juan Diego. And he lived in this village that was within walking distance of Mexico City, and he was studying catechism or something like that at the cathedral, and he would go there every day to study and to go to mass. And that on his way there one morning, he passed by this one location, and he heard a voice that was calling out to him, and he heard this music, and he turned around, and there was the Virgin Guadalupe. And so she told him to go tell the bishop that she was there. So he went, and I think he actually didn't get an audience with the bishop, but he just talked to some of his underlings, you know, and they scoffed at the notion. And so he went back, and he told her, well, that that they wouldn't listen to him, and he actually had what they called four apparitions. They called them those cuatro apariciones. I'm going to shorten the story a little bit, but he eventually wound up seeing her at a location which we called Tepeyac. And that was the location that had formerly been the pyramid of the Aztec mother goddess, who is generally known as Tonantzin. And she told him that he should pick these flowers that were growing there. And he was saying, well, it's impossible, these flowers, you know, there's never been any flowers here, all we got here is cactus. And he looked around and there were flowers. So he picked them, and he wore this thing that was kind of like a poncho, which is called a tilma. And it's woven out of yucca fiber. So he took a bunch of flowers and he gathered them up in the tilma, and he managed to actually get an audience with the bishop. And when he opened up the bishop and let the when he opened up the tilma, his poncho in front of the bishop, the flowers fell out on the floor, and on the tilma was the image of the Virgin of Guadalupe. So that's the image that you see everywhere. So it was supposed to have been this miraculous appearance, although it's since been proven that it's a painting. But what they're saying is that underneath it is an image that's sort of like the Shroud of Turin, and it was hard to make it out real clearly, or that the days were fading away, so they painted over it to give it more detail. You know, that's a sort of revisionist explanation about that nowadays. But the net result of all of that has been pretty interesting, because the Catholic Church is saying, well, that for every soul that was lost to the Protestant movement, you know, in Northern Europe, they regained a soul for the Catholic heaven or whatever by converting Indians in the Americas, because they were saying that that the Indians were resisting conversion to Catholicism, but that once they showed them the image of the Virgin Guadalupe, they changed their mind. So, you know, that's the legend, and I, you know, it's hard to say how much of that is true and how much of it is just, for instance, I guess the worst thing it could be was that it's to cover up all of the atrocities that they did to force them to convert. But there's other realities to this that I think people have overlooked. One thing that I found out recently, when they were going to canonize Juan Diego, they actually did a lot of research into to find out if he really existed or not, and if he did, who he really was. And I'll tell you, I did some work for this pretty well-known journalist named Michael Wood. Have you heard of him?
I'm not sure.
He's done a lot of specials on PBS and BBC. I think his most famous was called In the Footsteps of Alexander the Great.
He's the one that did that.
Yeah, and he did a series called The Conquistadors. And he was.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
Right, and he was especially interested in the person of Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca.
Mm-hmm. De Vaca.
Right. Now, a lot of people call him De Vaca, but that confuses him too with this other guy whose name was De Vaca, who was this, you know, bloody and cruel conquistador who slaughtered a lot of Native Americans in New Mexico. But actually, in Spanish, people have two last names. They have their mother's last name and their father's last name, and their father's last name comes first. So his real last name was Núñez, and Cabeza de Vaca was his mother's last name. That was the family that she was from. But he was shipwrecked off the coast of Florida. Actually, they say he was shipwrecked, but that isn't exactly true. What happened was that the guy that he was serving under, he was the second in command to this person whose name was Pánfilo de Narváez. And Pánfilo de Narváez was chasing down this legend that they were supposedly going to find another kingdom, just like the Aztec kingdom in Florida. And of course, it turned out that wasn't true. And he made this really dumb mistake of separating his ships from his troops and proposing to meet up with him up the coast somewhere. So apparently the ships were lost, or the men failed to meet up with him. So they built these rafts, and they were going to just sail these rafts all along the Gulf of Mexico and try to get to the the coast of Mexico, on the Gulf of Mexico, to the northernmost settlement there. And they didn't make it. I mean, most of them were swamped, or they died of starvation, or they were overturned by surf, and they were drowned, you know.
Mm-hmm.
By the time that they reached a location near Galveston, Texas, there were just a handful of them that were around, some like 5 or 6 years later, they finally escaped because they had actually been enslaved. They were held as slaves by
mm-hmm. Yeah, so they were.
And when they finally left, there were only four of them left. There was Cabeza de Vaca, and there was this guy who they called a Moor, you know, but he was a black African. And his name was Estevanico, and then two other Spaniards. And in the meantime, Cabeza de Vaca had become what Michael Moore describes as a, not Michael Moore, but Michael Wood describes as a curandero, because he was curing people of sicknesses and stuff just by laying hands on them and praying over them, and they were just bringing people to him in droves to do that. And it's very mysterious about why they thought they were going to do that, but what he says is that they just told him, well, you're going to cure people, and because we say so. And he was saying, well, that's impossible because, you know, it can't be done, and I've never done it before. And they told him, well, you're either going to do it or we're not going to feed you anymore, you know. So he said he just called on God to give him the strength to do it, or the ability to do it, and he was amazed at the results, that he would cure people of whatever they had. It didn't matter what sort of sickness or anything. And he did some really amazing things. Supposedly, he actually raised a guy from the dead. But he finally met up with the other three survivors, because all the rest of them had died, and they just left. They just ran away, and when they got out of the territory where they were in, and they got into that of the next tribe, their reputation was pretty well known. So they wound up just collecting these followers of these people that would just drop what they were doing and just walk along with them, and they usually had anywhere from like 200 to like 500 people that were just walking across the desert with them, and people were like joining up with them. And then they would reach these borders, because the different tribes had what were tantamount to their countries, you know. And like they would reach a point that's like, this is our border, and this is where the other tribe or alliance or whatever it was starts, so we're going to leave you here and you're going to go on. And then they would start picking up more people, and off they would go, and they just kept doing that. And they actually came through where I am now. They came through Ojinaga, and that's the only place that's actually been chronicled that they were. Every place else that they've been has been a matter of speculation, but they know that they went through Ojinaga, because later on there was another conquistador whose name was Espejo. And he was on his way up to New Mexico, and he talked to the Indians at what they called Junta de los Rios, which means the place where the rivers join, which is where Ojinaga is now. And they told him that, yeah, the Spaniard had been through here so many years before, you know, and it coincided when he would have passed through, and they described him. He was a guy that was running around with a loincloth, and he carried this staff that had a cross at the top, and he had two other white men and a black man with him, you know, so it was unmistakable who it was. So the thing is, he was very, very influential with the Indians. I mean, they loved him because he loved them. I mean, that's mm-hmm. really what it came down to, you know. It was a real personal relationship that he had with everybody. He came along and he would preach to them. He would tell them, you know, you shouldn't fight, you know, you should treat each other well, you should love each other well, and that we have a mother and a father who are up above, you know, referring to the Christian God and the Virgin Mary. And that's about as far as he wanted to explain things, but in a lot of ways this totally coincided with that, what they believed anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that this has had a lot of bearing on my thinking all along, but it's something that has sort of been resurrected several times in things that I discover or things that I investigate, you know.
Plus you got the legend of the healer that, you know, from maybe 1,000 years ago or more. You know,
right, but I want to take you based on the legend of, or the, it isn't a legend, but the story of Cabeza de Vaca, which I know very well because I was Michael Wood's fixer here in Mexico. I don't know if you know what that means, but I made all their arrangements and stuff, and I traveled with them and was a translator while they were filming in this part of the world. I'm going to go back to the Virgin of Guadalupe, and then I'm going to go to the Tower of Mar. Now, what Cabeza de Vaca was trying to do was this: that the Spanish had a law that you could not enslave a person who was baptized. That a person who was baptized and was within territory that was claimed by the Emperor of Spain was a Spanish subject and could not be enslaved, because the Spanish were enslaving Indians, and these slavers were ranging farther and farther out of the original territories that they were taking slaves, because they were taking them to work in these mines, and they would perish in the mines. You know, they would get tuberculosis, and they wouldn't last very long at all. It's like sending them to, like, it's kind of like the Nazis used to send people for slave labor in these factories, and they wouldn't feed them, and they would die in no time, so they could just go get another box boat car of them over in the Ukraine or someplace and just keep at it. And that's sort of what the Spanish were doing, and it was pretty outrageous. And Cabeza de Vaca, you know, was outraged by that because he identified more with the Indians than he did with the Spanish. And the Spanish were pretty outraged with him, but they really couldn't do anything about it because he was a high-ranking officer. You know, he was technically still in command of the Narvaez expedition, who had been commissioned by the governor of Cuba. And so he sort of, anybody who came along and got in his face, he outranked them, you know. So, I mean, if there was ever an audiencia in Spain, you know, anybody who got too smart with him would hang, you know. Even though he was this guy that was running around in a loincloth, you know.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osman back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated. And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie
Osman.
Put it
under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osman, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. That's a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
When he finally got back to Mexico City, you know, that became his life's work, that he was going to change their way of thinking, because Queen Isabella had issued an edict years before, even before they had come over to the New World, when they were talking about what they were doing on the Canary Islands, and she was saying that anybody that they conquered was going to be given the opportunity to convert to Catholicism, and if they did, they would become a Spanish subject. So what people were trying to say to get around that was they were saying, well, that the Indians didn't have souls, that they were animals.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't convert them. You couldn't baptize them, and therefore you couldn't make them Spanish subjects. And Cabeza de Vaca was saying that that was wrong. And but there were other people who got into the fight, and the most important was this guy who's known as Fray Bartolomé de las Casas.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually went over to Spain, and he argued this court case against his main adversary, this guy who was claiming just the opposite, and he won the case. But this was all due to Cabeza de Vaca's efforts. So when you think about what they were doing, you got to see that, or I see it this way anyway, that of course they saw that it was shameful in the first place that they should be mistreated in any way, that they shouldn't have been conquered, that they shouldn't have destroyed their culture, and they shouldn't have destroyed their civilization and all of that. But now it was really that they didn't have anything to do with that, and they were now in a different sort of stage in the game, and all they were trying to do was to prevent them from being enslaved and annihilated, you know, and to try to take steps to bring them to humanize the people who had been dehumanized.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Michael Wood recognized, and that's why his episode is called "All the World is Human," because that was the statement that they made. You know, that all living beings are humans, and you can't say they're animals, and therefore they all have a right to be baptized and become Spanish subjects, and therefore then they're equal with everybody else. And of course, nobody ever really went that far as to put that into practice. You know, I mean. But at least they were willing to say that it was true, and to sort of put up this charade, you know, which was hardly the same thing as redressing their real grievances. But it was the most that this handful of people that were trying to save them and defend them, you know, could hope for. And so their what they accomplished was really kind of amazing, you know, because they really overcame a lot of odds. So, consequently, my feeling about the fact of how they generated the story of the Virgin of Guadalupe and sort of set her in place in the Catholic pantheon or whatever is because of this. Because it was really an extension of what had been set in motion by Cabeza de Vaca and by the Virgin of Guadalupe, and it's something that sort of works its magic down to the present, because I found a lot of times, because a lot of Mexicans are real discriminatory or whatever, they have this racist attitude towards Indians, and yet they all say that they're followers of the Virgin of Guadalupe. So I always sort of throw that up in their face and I say, well, isn't the Virgin of Guadalupe Indian? You know, yes, she is. And so, well, would you discriminate against her? You know, would you, say mean things about her or mistreat her? Well, of course they wouldn't. Well, then why would you do that to these other Indians? Because they're her children too, just like you are. Maybe more so, you know, and they really don't know what to say about that.
Hmm. Yeah, I know things are changing down there, I guess, since the canonization, though. Things are really, really on the move down there.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that they discovered is that Juan Diego really was a historical figure.
Hmm.
And he was actually somebody who was pretty influential.
There's a lot of that's a polemical. there's
yeah.
People that argue for forever.
Well, it's just like when Michael. What this is another thing I learned when I was working with Michael Wood, that they had gone over to Spain, and they had dug these documents out of these old libraries that nobody had ever looked at since they were written back in the early 16th century. That these reports had been submitted. you might suppose that somebody might have reviewed them at one point, and then they were filed away, either in the Vatican or in these libraries in Spain. And they found out a lot of things about, for instance, the court case with Fray Bartolomé de las Casas and some of the things that had been written about Cabeza de Vaca or that he wrote himself. Well, they did the same thing with Juan Diego. They found that there were documents about him that nobody had reviewed before. And I read about that in this article that was written by this historian and anthropologist who writes for this newspaper down in Mexican State of Jalisco. And I found it online. And I read it, and he was saying that that Juan Diego was actually the prince of Texcoco, and that he was a general, that he commanded a division, which in their way of organizing things meant that he had at least 8,000 soldiers to command. And that they were, at the time, they eventually became allies of the Spanish and they fought against the Aztecs. So, I said, well, if he's Prince of Texcoco, that means that he's probably descended from Nezahualcoyotl, the guy that I was telling you about, and sure enough, he definitely was. He was his great-grandson. So, what you have here is a scenario wherein you have a handful of Spanish who were carrying out the program that was originally initiated by Cabeza de Vaca, and that Fray Bartolomé de las Casas picked up the ball and ran with it. And then other people got involved because they agreed with him.
From what Ron Pastore said in his interview was that the Devaca expedition started out being the largest, the most well-funded archaeological expedition of all time. And this was, so far flung, but they were. Have I got the right person, De Vaca?
He was. They were. Cabeza de Vaca was the treasurer of this expedition that was commanded by Pánfilo de Narváez. And Pánfilo de Narváez had another debacle before that because he was sent by the governor of Cuba to go arrest Cortez when Cortez was making a lot of headway in Mexico. And Cortez wound up talking all of his soldiers into joining him, and they had this little skirmish, and Pánfilo de Narváez got his eye poked out. And he wound up going back to back to Cuba all by himself because his soldiers stayed there with Cortez and went on to conquer Mexico. But after that, under the Narváez, because of his family connections, he was very well connected in Spain and also with the governor of Cuba, who was in effect sort of the main guy in all of the Americas, the most authority. And they actually put together this other expedition where they decided, well, if we missed out on Mexico, we're going to go up to Florida because they got the same stuff up there as they got in Mexico. But I don't know where they got that idea, but they were totally wrong. So they went marching in there to the Everglades, expecting they were going to have these pitched battles with these guys that were going to get out there and fight them with clubs and stuff like they had done in Mexico. And they wound up facing these guys who were shooting at them with these long bows, from behind these trees, that were fighting this guerrilla war against them, and they just decimated them. So that's what happened with them. So then, like I say, when the ones that managed to survive tried to go back to the coast and meet up with their ships, they never located them. And so they were just desperate, and they just built these rafts tried to escape on them, but most of them got sunk or turned over by waves, and nobody survived except for four of them. Now, a lot of people think that he went to New Mexico and Arizona, but that isn't true. Michael Wood proved it that wasn't so. Because for one thing, I should say that they actually were they had this uncanny way of navigating over land, wherein they would know how far that they traveled and in what directions they had gone in, to where, I mean, they were complicated. They were plotting this rather complicated mathematical sort of mapping technique, wherein when they finally arrived at their location where they met up with the Spanish and their journey was over, you know, they were actually able to tell them how many leagues, not only that they had traveled, but how many leagues as a crow flies it was from where they had gone aground in their raft to where they had arrived in Culiacán, Sinaloa on the Mexican West Coast. So this notion about them wandering all around into New Mexico and Arizona, it really doesn't hold up to scrutiny. They pretty much came in a straight line from where they last were to where they were planning on arriving, and that's where they got to by taking a pretty direct route. So there are a lot of things that are believed about him that have been since disproven.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
But when I was interviewing these Tarahumara Indians, you know, I found out that they have what we might consider some pretty strange religious beliefs, but I'm so used to them that I don't consider them to be unusual at all. But they believe that there are basically a god and a goddess, who they call those who walk above. And they think of one of them as our father and the other as our mother. And because they really are not too much into the use of images of any sort, they sort of have a vague notion that our father can be identified as being Jesus, and they use a crucifix for that, or just a cross. And that our mother, they identify with the Virgin Guadalupe. But generally speaking, they're not really concerned with images like that, because they think that those kind of serve to represent them because they don't make images of their own. But they would conceive of the, you know, our father as being a guy dressed as a Tarahumara, you know, an old Tarahumara man in their traditional clothing, and our mother as being an old Tarahumara woman dressed in the dresses that they wear, which are very distinct. So the imagery is about the least important thing. But they identify them with the sun and the moon. But generally, most of them, the idea they have is that the moon is the father and that the sun is the mother. Now, there are some of them that believe just the opposite, but the impression that I get are that the ones that do that is because of the influence of missionaries, that they don't want to give up their beliefs at all, and they get modified in these kind of strange ways, but it's just sort of the notion that they think, well, the father has to be more powerful than the mother, and the son's obviously more powerful than the moon. Why the son has to be the father and the moon has to be the mother, but the majority of them believe in the traditional way that the moon is the father and the son is the mother. And they also believe that people have more than one soul. They believe that men have three souls and women have four souls. So a lot of their beliefs concerning sickness, concerning witchcraft, and concerning healing have to do with these souls, because they believe that if a person is sick or if a person has been bewitched, that what happens is that one of their souls is missing. And so the most powerful of their medicine men are their curanderos, of which these people are pretty rare, actually, because this is considered to be something that not just anybody can do, but the people that are doing it are very respected and revered. disappear.
So do they do kind of a soul retrieval?
That's exactly what they do.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
And they do it in their dreams.
Some of the
it's called dream curing. And in their dreams, they go down this path, and they're looking for signs. It's like following the trail, and the signs are very hard to find. So in their dreams, they're crawling down this trail on their hands and knees, looking for signs until they finally arrive at the place where the missing soul is.
Very shamanistic.
Yeah, and I was reading about I've been reading about Tibetan culture, and they have some notions of greatness. So I think that this is something that's rooted in very ancient shamanistic traditions that they have in common with people that are racially and linguistically connected to them in Asia, and this especially includes the Mongols and the Tibetans.
Fascinating. Absolutely. Well, you've really done some detective work.
Yeah, well, I'm still at it, you know, and I keep finding out more amazing things. But I always wanted to meet a dream healer. And it just so happens that I have met one, I know one. And we're pretty good friends. I mean, we haven't known each other very long, but when I met him, I just sort of threw myself at him. I just said, hey, you know, I've always wanted to meet somebody like you. I would like to be your brother, you know. Everything that's mine is at your disposal. I don't do anything I can to help you.
Yeah.
I just want you to trust me and to consider me to be your friend. And it turned out he felt the same way. He always wanted to meet a gringo who would understand them and that would be willing to help them, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like we just found each other, you know? It was amazing.
Well, this is a time for understanding, you know? It's not a time to...
I think so.
Yeah, it's time for you guys to come together.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Because one thing I'm bothered with, really, is a lot of people who are, you know, New Agers and like, Chicano activists or whatever, who are trying to latch onto these things in order to spin off a lot of sort of hard feelings or a lot of pride or a lot of divisive sort of rhetoric, you know.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It's the little yellow pill that scientists say could eliminate chronic diseases and help you live well into your hundreds.
You might be able to increase the lifespan of a mammal by 50%. And, of course, if that was a human being, then that might be in the order of 130 to 150 years.
That claim might be hard to swallow. But tonight on ABC's Primetime Live, co-anchor John Quinones takes the promising antioxidant therapy called Protandim.
I have become a guinea pig for ABC News and Primetime. It's not a drug. It's a supplement. It's called Protandim, and it's a combination of five exotic plants that have been around for centuries.
Have you discovered the fountain of youth?
I wouldn't put it that way, but we may have discovered something that will tell us a lot more about how we age, what happens biochemically, and maybe how we can slow it down.
Quinones has been taking Protandim for 2 weeks now and tells Extra,
I am sleeping better, I feel a lot better, and also energized when I do wake up.
Primetime puts Protandim to the test tonight.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
And they're not really basing themselves in the realities of this. They're just trying to attach their shining star into stuff that seems exotic, you know. But I don't think it really helps anybody at all. And when they find out what the reality of it is, you know, they're really not too happy, you know, because it isn't what they expected it to be. It's what they've been claiming.
How do you feel about the whole Carlos Castaneda Don Juan thing? Did it help? Did it hinder? Did it do
well? Well, it's kind of it's fraudulent, but at the same time, it's helpful.
It's kind of like
because
I don't care what
you see. It and it gets people to get interested in it where
right.
it would have been
debunked
ignored it otherwise. But it comes to a point when they have to realize that it is fraudulent, and if they're really interested in that, they really need to find the real thing.
It's kind of like Truman says, I don't care what you say about me, just spell my name right. It got everybody's attention, a lot of people's attention.
Yeah, yeah. There's this book that's pretty well known among New Agers by this person who calls herself Miss Divine. I can't think of what her first name is, but it's not a real name. But she wrote this book where in living up in the state of Wisconsin and never having gone anywhere near Mexico or the Southwest, you know, she claims that she interviewed these women from Mexico and that they belonged to the secret society of Guadalupe, where they were supposedly like these white witches, and it was all pretty much based on Wicca and goddess culture and astrology and all that kind of stuff. And she got to have quite a following, but you know, critics have picked her apart pretty roundly because the whole thing's pretty absurd. But it's good though that just to bring the name of the Virgin of Guadalupe out there, because I'll tell you, it's amazing that you find people from all walks of life who are followers of the Virgin of Guadalupe, and they really don't care a thing really about Catholicism or Indianism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, either way, I mean, they don't care. But all they care about is just her, all by herself.
There's a lot of people that are...
Derive a lot of power from that.
Well, I consider myself part of the Marian movement, even though I'm not a Catholic. You know, I firmly believe that somebody that people are calling Mary has been appearing. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when the God of Wind and Water came to the Cherokee, comes in walking on the water and gets everybody's attention, and they said, well, what should we call you? And he says, I don't care. You know, but it's like, I don't think Creator cares, you know, what you're calling him, as long as the message is getting through.
Right. Well, right now, for instance, I told you that I belong to this email group, and it's pretty big. It has over 500 members. And the group was founded by these people who wanted to discuss the what they consider to be the reality that the Virgin of Guadalupe is really this Aztec goddess whose shrine was located where the Basilica of Guadalupe is right now in Mexico City, who they call Tonantzin. And but the Mexica were only there for less than 200 years, and they didn't really finish their ceremonial center until 1503, which means that it wasn't even around for 16 years, actually, before it was destroyed. So, you know, you can hardly say that represents this long history that gives more validity to something when in the face of the fact that the Virgin of Guadalupe has been around for darn near 500 years.
Yeah, do you think it was just a power
place? I think that there are power centers, you know, that these spirits or energies or gods or goddesses or saints or whatever you want to call them are located in these places. And
well, I know there's places like, you know, in Sedona where they have electromagnetic anomalies, and, you know, some people are beginning to think of Creator as the electromagnetic force in the universe that has different ways that it manifests itself.
There are millions, I mean, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of followers of just the Virgin of Guadalupe. I'm not talking about any other, you know, apparitions of the Virgin Mary or goddesses or whatever you want. I'm talking about just the Virgin of Guadalupe. And it's pretty universal that they think of her as a person who can stand before you just like any, like just a regular person, and you can talk to them. I mean, that's how they like to conceive of her. They don't like to think that there's some kind of energy or some nebulous ball of light or something like that. I mean, that is completely antithetical to the feeling that people have. You know, they feel like that they're having a relationship with her that's a one-on-one sort of thing. And a lot of this is is kind of central to the ideology that supports Kurenderismo, because a lot of what people are doing is that they're having these personal one-on-one situations with these spirits who may be saints, or they may be ghosts, or they may be anything, you know. And the same goes for the witches, you know, the brujas, whether they're practicing white or black magic, they're pacting with these spirits, you know, maybe saints, or they might be just about anything else. But they're not like, the way I see it is this, like, the way I like to explain it is this, it's like if there's like a cosmos, it's like an invisible world, and there are like these connections being made, you know, there isn't a system of like wires and pipes, you know, that's like taking these energies and stuff all over the place, you know. But it's more like there's a guy with a bucket, you know, who's like carrying it around, you know, and that would be, you know, one of these spirits that you have to somehow communicate with or convince to help you or not to harm you or whatever, you know. And another thing is the fact that a lot of these were actually persons, you know, and a lot of this is rooted in the tradition of martyrdom, which at the same time as it has its traditions that are connected with these Western religions, they also have something that's very similar to the ideology that supported human sacrifice. And in that sense, it's something that goes back to a time when, you know, the ancestors of the people in the Mediterranean and the Europeans were practicing that too. But at the same time, it has sort of an uncanny way of kind of linking into the culture of the ancestors of a lot of Native Americans in both North and South America, where people that were sacrificed, you know, a lot of times went willingly to that because it was like the idea that a martyr, you know, goes willingly to their martyrdom, but not in the sense that they're going to go off to some heavenly reward and not have anything to do with anybody else, but actually the notion is that they're going to be available. They're going to be available to come back and, like, go on these missions for the people that are still living. And in a way, that has a lot to do with the notion of what people in cultures that reverence their ancestors expect, that their ancestors are going to be available to them when they need them, to kind of do work for them on the spiritual plane. You know? So it's this ideology that is very ancient, and that it has diverse manifestations, but it's rooted in something that really is the same thing, even though in a lot of cases it appears to be something different.
Well, I know it's a fascinating subject. I know this is just going to be a teaser for folks, and I know if you're interested in what indigenous people are up to, and so, well, this is what some of them are up to, and it's kind of like, well, you know, these might not be strictly indigenous teachings, but it's like these are teachings that were indigenous to another place, you know, and they're not the everyday thing that, you know, your average Baptist or Methodist would get involved with, but it's, it has to do with faith, and there's a lot of things about what curanderos do that has a lot in common with, if you just take a look at the similarities with what people do in mainline Christianity, there's not a whole lot of difference.
Mesoamerican culture, as Dr. Robert Ghostwolf was pointing out, and a lot of other people have, was undoubtedly influenced by people who came over from the old world, you know, long before Columbus ever got here. For instance, I'm looking at this book. I really recommend this if you can find it. It's called Mysteries of the Mexican Pyramids. And it covers a lot of different subjects, but one of the things I'm especially interested in is that some of the material he has about these travelers from other continents that came over to Mesoamerica course, a lot of people are familiar with the legend of Quetzalcoatl, who was the feathered serpent, is what the name means. And he was a, they have this person that's called the historical Quetzalcoatl, who was a king of the Toltecs and who founded the Toltec city of Tula, or of Toyan, it's also called, which the archaeological ruins are near a place called Tula Hidalgo. And according to the Indian legend, he was a guy with fair skin and light hair and a beard, you know, and that at some point he got on a boat and sailed back towards the east and said that on a certain day he would come back, and on the date that he said that he would come back was the date that Cortez arrived off the coast of Spain, you know, so that was one reason why the Aztecs were sort of wound up having this sort of approach avoidance syndrome where they didn't know whether they should attack them or swear allegiance to them, you know, so they had these two parties, you know, that the pro-surrender group and the pro-go-to-war group, and they could never agree with each other. But there's a lot of speculation as to who he was, and what I'm thinking of as far as the historical period, because it's supposed to be about 950 AD that he left, that he must have been a Viking, actually. But there are, for instance, there are rock carvings in temples and other places that are real detailed in various locations in Mexico, and there are also pottery that show these people who are obviously Asians. They're these Semitic-looking guys. They look just like Babylonians or Hittites or Phoenicians. And they have this one guy. I'm looking at this picture of him here, and I'd say he has to be the Phoenician version of the wine god, because he has all these bunches of grapes all around him, but he's got this kind of curly looking beard and this curly hair that comes out from under this helmet that definitely has this kind of mid-eastern look about it from the period. And this other guy standing next to him looks just like a Babylonian. I mean, they look just like these friezes off the temple in Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
And then here's another one. Here's a cup that was found at a ruin in Tula, the Toltec capital. And it shows this guy with a beard and a mustache real clear, and he's got a lightning bolt in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And he's supposed to be a Tlaloc, which is the Toltec, the Mesoamerican god of lightning, but he looks more like the Phoenician Zeus, you know, it's like their god of lightning. And these sort of things are very common. They even earlier than that, the Mayans had these pictographs that showed this guy who was according to their legend had sailed over from the east in a boat, and his name was Itzamna. And they show him in one of the codices, and he's, like I say, he's sailing over from the east in a ship, according to their legend. So their legends, both in the codices and in traditions that have been carried out in other ways, and also in their artwork that you find in their temples, show things that are unmistakable that point at this connection. But on top of that, there have also been these glyphs, I mean, these hieroglyphics, these different alphabets, the Celtic runic alphabet, the ancient Hungarian alphabet, the Greek alphabet, the Phoenician alphabet.
A lot of it.
And they've been translated. There's this woman who specializes in that. I mean, she reads them and she says, tells you what the guy's name was, you know, and how many were in his party and what they had to say about it. There have been whole articles about that. You know, it's real clear that these people were all over the place. And a lot of
the, having a runestone in Oklahoma, you had Vikings in Oklahoma, and you had Phoenicians writing the Ten Commandments on a stone near Laguna, New Mexico, called the Decalogue Stone, and
there's a stone over by Albuquerque.
It's
really odd because it's written in the Celtic runes, but it's written in the classical Greek language. So like they had a guy with them who was a Celtic scribe, you know, but he was writing it down at the behest of the leader of their party, who was this Greek noble who had been exiled in Greece, and it was they estimated that the year was about 500 BC.
Did you hear about the tribe of Benjamin? Tribe of Benjamin drawings in a cave in the Colorado Valley that were identical to Benjamite drawings in caves in the Negev. This is at you go to I think it's viewpoint.com. Really interesting. They get into native, you know, mysterious stuff. Viewpoint's a really good website.
Well, the Aztecs were part of their society was fairly very obsessed with witchcraft, and they had this goddess who was like the god of witches. And in one of the codices, they show her flying a broom and having a conical hat.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting
right.
garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated. And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie
Osmond.
Put it
under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
I mean, it's just like something out of Halloween art or whatever.
I'll be done. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Well, that's really, really interesting. Well, do you feel like you're talked out?
I think so. I mean, I could go on forever, but I think you're going to put a link on your website where they can go into my little sort of web portal that leads to my different pages.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, you've got videos and you've got some audio stuff, too, or
right, and I would encourage people to join my email group if they really want to find out more about this, if they really want to get involved, because we have people there that are intensely interested in this, and some of them are very scholarly, and some of them are participants in it in different degrees, and also we have people that are participating in things that are very similar, like there are a lot of people that are into Santeria and voodoo and voodoo and things like that, which are African-based practices,
right.
But they're nevertheless similar to what's taking place in Mexico.
Now, some folks may be listening on internet radio. We've got Listen on Demand. We also broadcast on internet radio, so you might want to spell your domain.
Well, it's Curan Derismo, and that's
C-U-R-A-N-D.
C-U-R-A-N-D-E-R-I-S-M-O dot net.
It's not Curan Derismo. It's
no.
Curan Derismo.
Curan Derismo.
And if you have any problems, folks, you can go to prophecykeepers.com. There'll be a link to his his website forever. And prophecykeeperf.com. And you can, after this week, you can click on past guests, and he'll be in the lineup. So there'll always be a link with the picture of the only graphic I got for you is that picture of the Curandero Don. What's his
Don
name?
Martin.
Yeah, Don Martin.
Right.
A picture of Don Martin on there.
That's a good one.
Well, actually, I could put the Curandero. There's a picture of her also. There'll be a few pictures there. I don't have any that I know of. I don't have any pictures of you though.
Well, you don't need that.
Okay. Okay.
That picture of Don Martin's the best.
Good deal. Good
favorite,
deal.
Yeah.
And but we sure appreciate you. Sure appreciate you being on and. You discover some interesting things, in a few months, and have you back on.
Okay.
Or if you
hear
some other guests that people, some other elders or whatever, they might be interested in being on. If you feel like there's somebody that can transmit culture, that's what we're here for.
Okay. Well, I'll have more to say about the Tara Humara as time goes on, because this medicine man, I guess it'd be a good thing to call him. His name is Antonio Vasquez. And when he comes back, I think he's going to be here in a couple of days.
Oh.
I'm going to be working real closely with him and trying to find out a lot more about what he does. And
he speaks Spanish only, Mexican only?
Well, he speaks Tarahumara and he speaks Spanish, but his Spanish is a little hard to understand, but I'm getting used to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I can always translate, but what I would be interested in doing really is finding people who are who might need his help, because they can cure a lot of things that Western medicine can't cure.
Well, you can get in touch with Clifford Alford. He's at www.nassinc.org, and he was a past guest. He lives in not too far from you. He's in Las Cruces, and he networks with some of the curanderos on the north side of the border in El Paso. So, this is great. This is great. I really appreciate you being on.
Thank you.
All right. We'll look forward to having you on again. Ho.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of 2/3 of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
There is a growing movement of people who are deciding to make their lives better. At LifeVantage, we're in the business of change, of improving quality of life globally and restoring the ability to make dreams a reality. Your quest for personal fulfillment begins here. Our flagship product, Protandem, the Nrf2 Synergizer, is the key to fighting oxidative stress. This daily supplement, comprised of natural ingredients activates the body's antioxidant enzymes to eliminate free radicals, which cause oxidative stress. Protandim has been tested in the laboratories of renowned universities such as The Ohio State University, LSU, and the University of Colorado, Denver. These studies found on PubMed.gov, the U.S. government's online scientific library, clinically show that Protandim reduces oxidative stress.
When I saw that Protandim reduces oxidative stress by 40% in 30 days, I was all in for the rest of my life.
Everyone begs us for science as an industry. Where's your proof? Well, we have that also.
LifeVantage is devoted to advancing NRF2 science and leading the fight against oxidative stress.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Well, I cannot even imagine. And just for example, last night, you did a show last night that was 90 minutes starting at 7:30.
That's right.
Then you went through that. Then you came here. You're here this morning.
That's right.
Doing all of this.
It's nonstop. I don't sleep anymore.
No. All right, so where do you get the energy? Seriously, I mean, look at you.
Well,
I mean, we've known each other a long time. Yeah. We've passed. You don't ever get older.
Well, thank you. It's quite funny because, you know, people are kind of shocked when they hear that I'm 54 years old, and they say, how do you keep your youth? I have found something, Dr. Phil, that I think is the closest thing to the fountain of youth.
Oh, you do have a secret.
I have a secret, and I've never really talked about it. Well, I've been doing this for the last 2 years. It's called Protandim, and it works. And I'm telling everybody about this.
You feel differently.
I do.
Because you're running around like a chicken with your head cut off.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're hitting the times. You're getting where you're supposed
to be. On the spot all the time.
Now, I've got three sisters, and we get along great 1,500 miles apart. I cannot imagine.
It takes me 1,600 miles.
Yeah, but I can't imagine working with my sister every day. What do you do when you have disagreements? Because you have to have disagreements, right? Because
well,
you're both producers.
Yeah, we're both producers, and that's difficult because we're both type A. And you're going to butt heads. What's really interesting about the Donnie Marie duo is that it doesn't really matter how much we butt the heads when that curtain goes.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Of other times, let the wind. Let the truth